Okay, we appear to have Nick on the phone. So what we'll do is make sure he's coming through loud and clear and working, and then we'll talk to him about his new book, Body Snatchers in the Desert, a new take on the Roswell story, myth, fact, whatever you want to call it. It's Radio Misterioso. Thanks for joining us. Let's test the old phone. Nick, can you hear me?
No, not very well. Very, very vaguely.
Just a minute. How about that?
Hello?
You still there?
Yeah, I can just about hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll have to hold the phone up close then.
Okay.
Is that a little bit better?
Yeah, that's a bit better. That's fine.
Okay. Let me see if I can get... Whoa.
You are pretty faint, but I can make it out, so.
Can you still make me out?
Yeah, oh, that's better now.
Okay, then I've hooked it up properly.
Okay.
Even though we're getting some static. How about that?
That's fine.
Okay, great. All right, I sort of introduced you before we brought you on the air here. The book we're going to talk about is Body Snatchers in the Desert. However, you have written a few others, such as A Covert Agenda, British Government's UFO Top Secrets Exposed. That was the first one, right? Or was it Strange Secrets? Still there?
Yeah, say that again. I missed that. Sorry.
Oh, the first book was A Covert Agenda?
Yeah, The Covert Agenda came out in England in 97.
I see, yeah.
And that was a look at government files that had been declassified through the British government's equivalent to the Freedom of Information Act.
Uh-huh.
Then there was the FBI files, which was a look at FBI files. Cosmic Crashes in 99, then... Strange Secrets in 2003.
Okay, and then Three Men Seeking Monsters this year.
Yeah, but that obviously was nothing to do with UFOs. That
no,
was
not really.
Interest to mine, cryptozoology.
More of a, cryptozoology, Freudian bent. And then just about a month ago was Body Snatchers in the Desert.
That's right.
And I wrote down a bunch of questions here, and my first question was, oh, come on! Which is probably what you hear all the time. But what got you involved? Well, actually, maybe we should talk about the kind of give a like a nutshell, maybe a minute or two summary of what's going on in the book, so people know where we stand,
okay.
And then we'll go on from there.
All right. Well, basically, the book is a new look at the Roswell story. Basically, over the course of about the last since 96, I should say, I've interviewed a number of retired military and intelligence insiders who suggested there was another explanation or definitive explanation, as they put it, for the Roswell story,
uh-huh.
being that it didn't involve aliens or mogul balloons or weather balloons or crash test dummies. It was actually allied to a program involving Japanese prisoners of war brought over, utilized in various dark and dubious experiments, some high-altitude experiments, some just using straightforward POWs who were trained to fly radical aircraft designs to attack the US, and these designs and experiments were continued in the United States. And the thrust of it is that these investigations and tests were undertaken and then hidden underneath a UFO banner, if you like. So that's kind of the broad angle, that it had kind of a down-to-earth explanation, but I guess in many ways more controversial than the alien theory, ironically.
Right. What got you involved? I mean, what made you want to write this book? What kind of cued you that there might be something else going on
you
with
mean,
the Roswell story?
What got me cued as far as just in UFOs in general, or do you mean the book specifically?
Well, let's do the UFOs in general. I usually ask that of people, but the book was drawing such commentary that I was so excited. But yeah, what got you interested in the first place? Why even care about such things?
The how and why, if you like, of why I got interested in UFOs is my dad was in the British Royal Air Force. He worked on radar, and he was actually involved in several incidents himself in the early 1950s, involved with tracking UFOs on radar over the English Channel in the English North Sea. And these are objects moving at fantastic speeds and carrying out all sorts of bizarre and incredible maneuvers, literally left and right-hand turns, you know, the sort of things that would just pulverize a pilot, you know, just destroy him. And it was quite clear that, you know, this wasn't a sneak attack by the Russians or anybody like that, and it wasn't anything, as far as anybody knew, that the Americans or the British or anyone else was flying. And they tracked these objects actually over the course of several nights, and everybody involved in the incidents, from the ground crew to the radar operators to the pilots that were sent in up to intercept these things, was told not to talk about it, reminded of the fact that they'd signed the British government's Official Secrets Act, which has all sorts of legislation just basically, you know, to sort of throw the book at anyone who talks out of turn. And told, you know, you won't discuss this outside of official channels, and, you know, you certainly won't go to the press or anybody like that with the story.
Uh-huh.
This was 52, and he kept this to himself until he told me round about, I think it was round about 78, something like that, 77, 78. And I guess that's what really got me interested, not just in the UFO subjects per se, but also from understanding and appreciating that credible people, you know, trained observers were seeing these things, and that the government seemed to know something about it and was trying to hide this information. So that's how I got interested in UFOs. But how I kind of turned that into writing was that when I left college, I worked on a punk rock music magazine back in England called Zero, and it was sort of like music and fashion based gigs and, you know, just things like that. And so I had an interest in writing, and then combined the two, you know, and started doing UFO writing for fanzines, you know, and small self-published newspapers and magazines and journals, that sort of thing. And then it kind of spiraled from there, I guess, and then, you know, I began doing more high-profile articles and books and lectures and, you know, to the point where we are today with Body Snatchers.
Did you said that your dad and people working with him were told not to say anything, so why did he tell you?
Well, this was basically sort of 25 years later when he related it to me. What actually happened was that we went to see Close Encounters when that came out, so that whatever year that was when he told it to me.
78,
okay.
77 or 8.
And, you know, he basically was just looking to, I suppose, relate the story, and at that time, 78, I was like 13 years old. And I mean, obviously I knew my dad was in the Royal Air Force, that was his job, working on radar.
Yeah.
But he never really discussed this particular incident. He still talks about it to this day, you know. He doesn't, to his credit, he doesn't sort of elaborate on theories and ideas and, you know, try and guess what it was. He just relates what happened. And so,
right,
you know, this is one of the ironic things that I'm still trying to get across to people today with the book, that, you know, I'm firmly convinced that there's a genuine UFO mystery. I'm not so sure that the Roswell event is actually part of that UFO mystery, but there's no doubt in my mind, you know, that something's up there flying around.
Did you, what kind of reaction have you gotten? I mean, this will be involved in all the questions we get into here, but you'd think that this holy grail of ufology, any arrows thrown at it immediately will have a bunch of soldiers coming out and forming ranks. Did that in fact happen, or how severe was that?
Oh yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, Roswell, you know, is kind of the cornerstone, if you like, of much of the UFO subject. And I guess the response that's come forward since publication of the book is pretty much what I anticipated and expected before publication. There have been certain people who have said, you know, that they think I'm right on the money, that this is, you know, the complete answer. Other people have suggested that maybe it's part of the answer. Actually, one of the intriguing things on that angle that several people have suggested all independently is that maybe, you know, some huge balloon tests were undertaken, and because some of these, you know, were large balloon systems with large balloon trains beneath them, that one of these things actually collided with a genuine UFO. And so this is why you have this story about balloons and crashed UFOs all in the same area, which is an intriguing angle. Other people think, you know, that maybe I've got part of the story. Other people just think I've been outright disinformed, you know, just to further cloud the murky waters of Roswell even more.
Yeah, we can get into that.
Those
too.
Are, I guess, pretty much the expectations I had for the publication of the book and, you know, what people would be saying about it.
Okay. Hey, we've just been joined by my pal Walter Bosley here. Have you met him, Nick? He was...
Who's sorry?
Walter Bosley, he's actually a former employee of AFOSI, Air Force Intelligence.
No, isn't he the guy who was involved in going around the UFO conferences in the 80s and,
yes.
You know, all the things with the stealth bomber and things like that?
No, in the 90s I did. Yeah. I did.
I'm kind of losing you a little bit. You faded a little bit.
Oh, can you hear me still now?
Yeah, you faded. I can pick it up, though. So.
Okay. But yeah, that before that he was a special agent with the FBI.
Oh no, I was
special agent with AFOSI.
Investigative specialist.
Okay. So we've talked about what the book is, kind of what the reaction was, but how about some background kind of on the book? Why did you, you know, how did you get interested in doing this book? Who came up to you, and or did it just come out of your head, or how did you originally get the idea for this thing that pisses everybody off?
Initially, this is one of the things I want to stress, that why it's kind of curious, is that when I guess, first began digging into this, I wasn't actually doing any research into Roswell at all. Most of my research, being British, was focused upon determining what the British government knew about the UFO subject and analysing British government files. And it was as a result of this research, I guess, that I did a TV show in England in 1996 called Out of This World. And, you know, as often happens when UFO people do interviews or promote books or promote TV shows, you know, you get feedback. And a guy contacted me who said he had some information about the British government's involvement in the UFO subject and asked if we could meet at Euston Railway Station, which is a big railway station in
central
London. Is
this that Levine character?
Sorry?
Is this that Levine character?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay,
Levine.
I was trying to remember his name.
Okay. And basically what happened was that he related this story to me about how he'd been exposed to certain files and even film footage of what was purported to show an alien autopsy. This was basically as part of an intelligence operation that allegedly involved the British government and the US government. Bearing in mind that in 1980, when Bill Moore's and Charles Berlitz's book, The Roswell Incident, came out, I guess nobody knew at that time where the story was going to lead and if it was going to blow wide open or if it was just going to, you know, vanish into obscurity.
Mm-hmm.
And Levine said that what happened was that the Americans, the American government or the intelligence community, had learned through intelligence channels that certain US UFO researchers had approached British counterparts, if you like, to see if they could assist in any way on you know, opening up the story further. And basically what it came down to was that a number of surveillance operations were launched upon US UFO researchers that were looking into Roswell, and the Americans wanted the assistance of the British government to basically keep watch on who was saying to what in Britain. Really just to say, you know, who was talking to who, what was being discussed, and so on. And Levine was exposed to aspects of this. What he told me was interesting was that the British government was very, very suspicious of the story told to them by their American colleagues about the fact that a UFO had crashed. And apparently they were shown, as I mentioned, some sort of film footage, very much like the so-called alien autopsy film. Which again in itself is controversial.
Yeah.
But what he said was that the British were highly suspicious that they actually hadn't been given the true story about what happened at Roswell, and digging on their own parts had led to the theory that it had more to do with, as he put it, high altitude experimentation in the summer of 1947 with balloon research and advanced aircraft research, and some of this material and plans had been found at the close of the Second World War when Japan was taken after the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And some of these plans involved very, very high-altitude balloon flights, kind of hybrid-type devices with aircraft firmly fixed to these balloon arrays as like a payload.
This
and then
is
the plan was to try and have the pilot, if you like, when it reached a certain height, detach the aircraft. So it's almost like a rudimentary and early attempt at a vertical takeoff.
Levine
scenario.
Told you all this?
And this was related to me in 96. And, you know, I'm sure like you, you know, you get told stories like this from time to time that you investigate or you listen to that sound really interesting, but, you know, there's no more corroboration and the guy's not really willing to speak on the record. He's still in employment. And so, you know, you just file it away as one of those intriguing tales, which is largely what I did. Now, in 2001, in the summer of 2001, I gave a lecture at the LA MUFON group. I can't remember the exact date, but it was July 2001. And prior to the lecture, I'd actually had a letter and a follow-up email from a lady who worked at the Oak Ridge installation in Tennessee in the 1940s and early 50s. And she'd read my book, The FBI Files. Now, that book included a chapter on FBI files on UFO encounters in the late 40s and early 50s at Oak Ridge.
Right.
And because she said she'd read the book and wanted to talk to me, I naturally assumed that she wanted to talk about the chapter in the book and maybe even the sightings or the people referenced in the files. You know, maybe she was even one of the people. And so we met for breakfast while I was still in Los Angeles. I was there for about 4 days either side of the lecture. And so we basically got talking, and as I said, I thought she wanted to talk about the book because she said she'd read it and she worked at Oak Ridge. But she said she wanted to talk about something else, and this was kind of a very similar story to that of Levine. And it was basically, again, connected with the idea that the Roswell incident and a number of the so-called UFO crash stories from the summer of 1947, and possibly a little bit earlier and possibly a little bit later, were actually, again, allied with highly controversial high-altitude flight, high-altitude exposure flights, determining the effects of cosmic rays on the human body and cells, cell mutation, that sort of thing. And, again, it's a matter of official record that tests along these lines were undertaken. It's just the extent to which and the, you know, the controversial nature that we haven't been able to verify officially. But what was kind of interesting to me was that here was someone 5 years after I got a very, very similar story from somebody in Britain telling a very, very similar story, but from their own perspective. You know, this elderly lady now is like 84 years old, so then she was like 80 years old when I did the interview. And of course, you know, you don't just simply take people at their word because they say, you know, I was involved in this particular incident or I knew about the fact that these UFO crashes were a cover for highly classified, high-altitude balloon flights that went wrong, and then people, maybe one of these things crashed off range and they were inadvertently seen by civilians, and then you had these stories about strange flying contraptions springing up in the area.
Hey, Nick?
Yeah.
What was this Black Widow woman doing at a UFO lecture? Why was she interested in UFOs?
No, she wasn't at the UFO lecture.
Oh, she wasn't?
No. What happened was that she, as I said, she contacted me some time prior to say that she'd read the book and would like to speak to me.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And because her address was in Los Angeles, I said, well, you know, we can correspond by mail, but I'm actually going to be in Los Angeles in July 2001. And
okay.
So I said, and she said, well, you know, this is where I live in Los Angeles. And I said, well, this is where I'm going to be. I said, but I'll have a car while I'm over. How about we meet up? And then, you know, it would be the perfect arrangement. So she wasn't actually at the conference. I met her the day after the conference.
So this was essentially 5 years after this first
contact
with Levine.
The Levine one was August 96, and this was July 2001.
Okay.
And as I said, it was just, according to her, purely and simply the reason she wanted to contact me was because she'd read my FBI files book, which had a chapter on the installation where she was working at the time, Oak Ridge. Now, as I said, you know, I don't just take people at their word, however credible or honest they might seem. And so what I always do is, you know, ask for some sort of verification. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion within the UFO community about things like the MJ-12 documents. You know, are they real? Are they fake? Are they disinformation? And, yeah. You know, the last thing I would have wanted would have been, you know, the equivalent of something like that. And to her credit, she was able to supply me the sort of things that was encouraging to me. What that actually included, specifically from her perspective, was tax records, tax files. Now, you know, it'd be incredibly difficult to, or so it'd be incredibly easy, you know, to get an old typewriter and an old stamp and just fake a Majestic 12 type document and present it as a photocopy which couldn't be analyzed for original paper or original ink.
Mm-hmm.
But she was able to show, demonstrate to me, you know, the sort of documents that all of us would collect, you know, within our working career. You know, if I was to say to you, Greg, prove to me that you worked in a particular job 15 years ago, you know, you might have tax returns and files and accountant files, that sort of thing.
Right.
What she also had was actually a number of photographs taken on base.
Which base?
I'm sorry?
At Oak Ridge?
Yes.
Okay.
Which, and it was quite clear that, you know, you were looking at photographs of a woman, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and now, today, I was sat opposite a woman, you know, 80, and it was quite clear it was the same person. So, in terms of who the person was, that aspect of the story checked out. And I guess I found it more intriguing because, you know, it swung back to this story from Levine from 5 years previously.
Yeah.
So, you know, here were two people, as I mentioned in the book, on opposite sides of the world, telling broadly a similar story, but from their own perspectives, Levine
right.
having received this briefing, and the woman actually claiming to have seen a couple of the bodies and have been told about the other ones. Now, one of the things I didn't go into to any great extent in the book, and I would have liked to have done, but that was sort of largely out of my control from an editorial perspective, was the way in which I tracked down the people, or the way in which the interviews were arranged and the circumstances.
Yeah, there's far more interviews in there than we've gotten to yet. So
sorry, say that again.
There's far more interviews cited in the book than we've gotten to yet. In fact, some quite more extensive than Levine or this Black Widow character.
Yeah, she was kind of like the catalyst, I guess, because, you know, Levine was on the other side of the world and I never saw him again, never spoke to him again. She actually stayed in touch with me, and where it gets a little bit controversial, and as I said, I don't go into this any great deal in the book, because the publishers wanted to kind of do it with just the facts, if you like, not with the personal perspective of me, you know, saying something like, you know, it was midnight and I jumped in the car for a journey to into the unknown, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that literally was the way it worked out. What happened was that the lady I referred to as the Black Widow, who worked at Oak Ridge, she actually knew one of the other sources in the book, purely because he was involved in an operation at Oak Ridge in the early 50s to smoke out a potential Soviet mole. And in turn, he...
Ah, that subject again.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll
and
get
in
to
turn,
that later.
He was also in touch with one of the other guys, and one of the things is actually down to one of those weird chance coincidences is that there's another source in the book who identify as the Colonel, and he and one of the other interviewees were actually both attended a conference in 1952, which is actually a verifiable conference on the psychological warfare aspects of ESP. And the fact that this was held in Washington in the summer of 1952, and I've been able to verify that this conference did go ahead. What I'm trying to do now is find the official minutes and records of the conference
yeah.
to see who else was in attendance and who might be able to add more to this particular story. But basically, this is what happened, that some of these people were sort of tangentially connected with one another, and because they were all exposed to different facets and aspects of the story, they came to know each other. And so they were basically like a group of elderly people sitting on this particular story, wondering whether or not to release it. And as it turned out, that the Black Widow told me the basics of it and actually provided the names of one of the sources, although not two of the other sources, but revealed enough information which actually allowed me to get on the tail and chase down these other people. And one of the interviewees, Al Barker, was actually furious when I managed to track him down and literally denied being the person who he claimed to be. Because although the four of them knew each other and had been sitting on this story, she, the Black Widow lady, had literally just come out and told me without consulting with these others first.
Oh, I see.
So it was sort of, she let the cat out of the bag, if you like. And, you know, it's like I say to people, and as I said to her, you know, she was concerned after she told me, well, what are you going to do with the story? I said, well, I'm going to pursue it to the best of my ability. And, you know, she was concerned. And I said, well, you know, it's the old saying, like, you know, you can't be a little bit pregnant. It's like the train's already rolling down the track.
Yeah, if you didn't
if
want
someone's
me to do
gonna reveal
about
that
it,
much to me, it's an extraordinary story. I'm sorry, but I'm going
to
look into it.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what I did. And as you'll see from the notes section in the back of the book, I did the interview with her in July 2001. And then, although I'd hooked up with all of the other sources, apart from one, identified as the Colonel, in 2002, there was this huge gap from July 2001 until the end of 2003 through 2004, when I did all the rest of the interviews. And the reason why there was this huge time gap of about 18, 19 months was simply because I could not get the sources to speak to me, you know, in a full interview format in that period. They were just, you know, concerned.
Yeah.
Now, one of the sources, the Colonel, actually came up to me at Ryan Wood's conference in 2004, his crashed UFO conference.
Yeah.
And what was interesting about this was that he just identified himself at the time as someone who had an interest in the work I've been doing and presented himself in that fashion.
Did he live in Vegas,
actually? What I
actually
didn't know until he revealed to me later on, he was actually one of the people who I was trying to track down, who I suspected knew aspects of this story from
Nick?
The Black Widow.
Did he actually live in Vegas as well? Did he just wait?
No, he didn't. He lives in D.C. He actually, this is the weird thing. This is one of the things that actually isn't in the book, and I'm actually trying to work on a follow-up to this right now, even if I have to do like a self-published thing.
Because it would indicate that he made an
effort. He
wasn't
even attending the conference. He was just quite literally at the hotel. He flew out because he knew I was speaking at that particular conference.
Okay.
And tracked me down through my room number and arranged a meeting at the hotel. And so he, you know, he wasn't even an attendee. It was just a case of him flying in. And
so he flew out there specifically to talk to you?
That's well, according to him, I mean, I can only tell you what he told me, but he said he specifically flew out not even to attend the conference, because, you see, this was one of the things that I was obviously going to do. If he was attending the conference, the next thing I was going to do was get the full roster of names of all the conference attendees off Ryan Wood, you know, to sort of delve more into his background. But the story I got was that he came out literally for the interview, or to meet, and alluded that he wanted to speak to me more. And I said, well, you know, I'm fine to speak to you. That's no problem at all. And we arranged actually to make a meeting in the town where I was living at the time. And what happened was that it was at the second meeting, then he revealed his card and said, well, I'm actually one of these people you're trying to find. And that the, you know, the Black Widow, who had inadvertently, I guess, sort of blown the whistle on, if you like.
Yeah.
And so then it was a case of me speaking collectively to these four people, each of who had their own unique angles and aspects to the story.
So what was his angle? Call him the Colonel. What was his angle?
Well, his angle was this, that he'd been working actually in the Defense Department since the 50s in an intelligence capacity. And in the from the early 60s, after its initiation, he was working in the Defense Intelligence Agency until his retirement in 69. Now, he said he was involved in several operations which he actually wasn't given full details of. And that sounds kind of odd, but I'll explain to you what he meant by this. He was involved in several operations which involved the DIA and OSI, the Air Force OSI, and possibly a couple of other agencies, actually spreading bogus UFO tales to the Russians. And he said this involved everything from not just crashed UFO stories, or as he actually put it in his own words, frozen spacemen under Langley. So this obviously sounds, you know, like spreading fake stories about crashed UFOs and alien bodies hidden under the CIA building at Langley.
Uh-huh.
But also bogus stories about pilot encounters, radar encounters, even... There was one interesting thing was that there was also an allusion to the fact that possibly some of the so-called contactees were official plants to A, make the UFO subject seem less than credible. You know, we're talking about flights around Venus and so on.
Right.
But also put them in place to feed some of these stories back to the Russians. Now,
and see where they came out in Russia to see who they were listening to.
Yeah, well, this is what it came... It actually came down to two things. One was to... One of the things he said was that the Russians were actually on the trail of Roswell in the 60s. Although the UFO community, the research community, didn't really start digging into crashed UFOs into the late 70s, until the late
right.
70s. You know, there was this huge gap from when research was done into the Frank Scully, the Aztec story in the late
right.
40s and early 50s.
Right.
Then there was this huge gap until things kicked off in 78, 79. But he said at an intelligence level, the Russians were deeply trying to find out what was going on at Roswell. And he said that he was part of his job, at least, to be involved in these particular operations of spreading and feeding bogus stories to the Russians. And he said they had these wonderful plans where they would carefully create and craft these bogus documents, but that looked like the real thing, DIA documents, CIA, NSA, just feeding them to the Russians. And he said it was twofold. One was to obfuscate and confuse what really happened at Roswell, and the other one was to try and smoke out Soviet moles that might be within the Pentagon and the Defense Department. So if these files were sent to Russia and there was somebody like a Russian sympathizer over here, they would then listen on the intelligence channels to see if anybody in Russia was saying to any, you know, any potential sympathizers
yeah.
in the U.S., hey, do you know anything about this
right.
particular file we've just received?
Right. Agent A knows about a crash. Agent B knows about a pilot encounter. Agent C knows about something else. And
yes.
then in Russia, you find out somebody tells about a pilot encounter, and the only person that knew about it was Agent B, so they start looking at him.
That's correct. That's exactly what happened. And so it was basically trying to reinforce to the Russians that there are all these super-secret UFO projects going on. And for a while, he, incredible as it sounds, his involvement was in spreading these documents, but he wasn't initially told as to precisely why it was being done. And that was the same with some of the other sources I interviewed, that they knew that bogus UFO documents, and particularly crashed UFO documents, were being created and were being spread to Russia, but they weren't entirely sure why it was being done. And he finally got a briefing as to what the true situation was. And again, it came down to a very, very similar scenario, but told from his perspective, based on what he knew, similar to the Black Widow and Levine. Again, the fact that in New Mexico in summer 47, various operations and experiments had been undertaken, primarily high-altitude balloon-based operations, but also some involving blueprints and designs brought back from Japan at the end of the Second World War that were sort of very, very similar to the so-called designs of the Horton brothers, sort of swept-back, delta, half-moon-shaped type aircraft.
These were two German aeronautical scientists.
Yeah, the Horton brothers were aviation geniuses,
yeah.
You know, working on advanced aircraft designs that I guess, you know, in some ways at least, I mean, not, you know, down to the nitty-gritty, but in some ways were sort of very much like the flying wings of the late 1940s, and in many ways, you know, not dissimilar to the so-called stealth bomber of today.
Uh-huh.
But all the sources told me that what happened, there was this clearly delineated period from early 47 to late 47, although they all conceded that they'd heard rumors about things going on before, but not too much after that period, that involved, as they put it, so-called dipshit operations, really just trying various new and novel experiments out to see if they'd work. And some of them, you know, literally failed catastrophically, hence the fact that we now have these crash legends. You know, they just simply did not work.
So
and
you're,
one
what
of the
you're,
ones...
Are you, is your idea that every single UFO crash legend, or at least most of them, have to do with these, classified aeronautical projects? The
well,
dipshit
you know,
projects.
I mean, I wouldn't want to, you know, sort of grandly and arrogantly state
tar
that,
everything
you know,
with the same...
Every,
yeah.
yeah, I wouldn't want to sort of grandly and arrogantly state that every UFO crash can be applied to a secret aircraft. What I have done in the book is included a chapter titled The Crashed UFOs That Never Were, and which clearly shows that a number of UFO crash stories were intentionally and officially created. I mean, I'll give you a few classic
yeah,
examples.
Exactly.
There was there was one alleged UFO crash on the island of Spitsbergen near Norway in the early 1950s. And it was broadly similar to the Roswell story, that a UFO crashed and that these weird alien bodies were on board. And it was recovered by the military in a similar scenario. Now, what's particularly interesting, if you go to the website of none other than the National Security Agency, you can download in PDF format all of their UFO documents that have been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act. And there's one particular document, which is a translation of a Russian magazine article on UFOs from the 60s that an analyst has translated. Now, the Army, the Air Force, the CIA, and the NSA, and the State Department have all released their own copies of this document because they were all on the distribution list for it.
Oh, okay.
The NSA's document actually differs in one respect. In the section that deals with the Spitsbergen crash, somebody has circled that entire section and written in the margin the word plant. So that makes that sound like that was a planted story. Now, on top of that, you have the story of Carl Flock, who was deeply involved in investigating, and still is, the Aztec UFO crash story of 1948,
right,
again from New Mexico. What's most interesting about that is that Carl, under curious circumstances, was shown, I guess in some ways by a mystery figure, a copy of the diary of Silas Newton, one of the people who was allegedly involved in just creating this spurious crashed UFO story. And as Carl relates, Newton's diary talks about how in the early 50s Newton was actually visited by someone from the intelligence world who we're not entirely sure, but in simplistic terms, what it came down to is they offered him kind of a deal where they said, well, you know, he was a bit of a con man, or a large con man, if you like, and they said,
yeah,
we'll help you keep you out of trouble if in return you keep spreading this UFO, crashed UFO story, even though we know it's bogus. So in other words...
This was in his diary?
This was in his diary. And I mean, Carl Flock, you know, is no fool. Carl's ex-CIA.
Right.
You know, and he was actually talking about seeing this diary and spoken on the record about it, which actually says that, you know, intelligence people came to Newton and said, look, we know you're spreading this story, we know it's fake, we know it's nonsense, but please keep spreading it. And, you know, there are several other examples in the book. For one classic one, there was an alleged UFO crash at a place called Kingman, Arizona in 1953.
Yeah, you said this was related to the Mercury test site.
Yeah, well, what happened was that there was an atomic bomb, series of atomic bomb tests undertaken in Nevada in this exact period, and the tests were called Upshot Knot Hole. That was the code name of the tests. And reportedly, a UFO crashed with a small body at the height of these tests. You know, the theory was that perhaps it was blown out of the sky as a result of the explosion and the mushroom cloud and so on. Well, one of the interviewees to the book gave me a tip and said, you know, don't focus on Arizona, don't focus on 1953. What you need to do is focus on Kirtland Air Force Base in 56. And the guy gave me the file number and title of a particular file, which can be found at the National Archives,
right,
titled Early Cloud Penetration. And what it reveals is that in the exact time frame and location of the alleged Kingman crash in 53,
right,
the U.S. Air Force flew a prototype radio-controlled drone aircraft through a mushroom cloud, which had a crew, if crew's the right term, of monkeys on board. And it was just to see how, you know, the crew would stand up to exposure to a mushroom cloud.
Uh-huh.
Now, the story that I got from the source was that this thing crashed, or went off course, or went out of control and crashed, and that the genesis for the crashed UFO story in this little body was actually the crash of this prototype drone with this crew of monkeys on board.
Right.
Now, again, people say, well, that's just nonsense. But, you know, I found the official files. They're at the National Archives.
Yes, Nick, but they could have been planted there.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, perhaps there's a UFO crash and then somebody brought in a drone and went to the local zoo and got a bunch of monkeys.
Yeah.
You know, to me, the more logical explanation is probably the correct one. But the point is,
right,
around Aztec, around Spitsbergen, around Kingman, you had all these crashed UFO stories suddenly surfacing, but when you trace back, in each of these cases, you see things like plant references, remote-controlled drones with monkeys on board. You see the official world asking people to, you know, keep spreading bogus UFO tales. And, you know, when that happens more than once or twice or three, four times, you begin to see a pattern developing,
right,
which suggests that there has been a high degree of manipulation with regard to the crashed UFO controversy.
Well, you know, actually, there's one part in your book, and I was taken to task for this in the Benowitz book by another author. He said that the CIA never used UFO stories to cover up anything that was going on with either them or anything they were tasked to get intelligence on.
Right.
And according to your book, it was at least talked about.
It was the what, sorry?
The subject of UFOs, as far as the CIA was concerned, was talked about as a cover for tests that were going on, stories they could hand out to people, covers for experimental aircraft.
Yeah.
And I was taken to task saying, well, the CIA never did this.
Mm.
However, you found in your book that, at least to some extent, they were talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the interesting things
did
is
they
that,
actually
you know,
do
a lot
it?
Of people talk about the Project Sign and the Project Grudge reports, you know, the early UFO investigations. Now, I think, you know, when you talk about disinformation, one of the key things that comes along is psychological warfare, you know, influencing the opinions of the enemy or whoever the target is. If you look at one of the early Project Grudge reports, actually from 1948, it talks as far back then about sharing all the data on UFOs with the Defense Department's psychological warfare experts. So even as far back as 48, never mind, you know, when things like the Robertson panel kicked off in the 50s, even that far back, they were talking about UFOs in a perspective of psychological warfare.
Right.
And, you know, even whether or not people agree with this particular statement or not, you know, it is a fact that the CIA have stated on the record that there was a degree of confabulation, if you like, in terms of hiding U-2 flights in the 50s behind a UFO smokescreen, you know, letting people think it was UFOs if they happened to see these high-flying U-2 aircraft.
But they flew so high, how could people actually see them?
Well, that's one of the things that makes this thing particularly controversial. But, you know, nevertheless, the CIA itself, ironically, has admitted to, you know, using the UFO subject in that particular way to hide U-2 flights. Some people dispute that happened, but
uh-huh.
The fact that the CIA have stated it did, you
yeah.
know, has kind of left the area.
The funny thing is that he said the CIA should never be trusted as a commentator on its own history. Yet the same author said that he trusted the Air Force's comments on its history, which
yeah.
I found a little strange.
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, we always need to kind of be careful about when we say the government this or the government that. You know, I think as anyone who delves into the intelligence world, never mind on UFOs or whatever the subject is, you know, the whole way secrets are kept is because only certain people know within a certain agency what they need to know. You know, this is what always makes me suspicious of certain whistleblowers. You know, they just stroll into an aircraft hangar and happen to see a crashed UFO and alien bodies. You know, the typical stories told to Leonard Stringfield.
Uh-huh.
You know, that I'm sure that does not happen. What I am sure that happens is that, you know, you have boxes within boxes and little departments that are involved in one particular thing that's, you know, just because you're joined the CIA, you're not, it would be absurd to imagine that you would be exposed to, you know, the inner secrets of the organization. You're told what you need to be told to do your job. So I think,
right.
you know, we need to delineate between what, quote, the government or, quote, the CIA knows beyond what a small group of people cleared in one particular area know.
Right. Hey, Walter, when you were working
yes.
on UFO, tracking UFO stories and leaks
right.
with the Air Force, how much of the story did they let you know about? Such as if you went out to this base and saw something on a pylon there being tested.
Right. Well, I was out there for there was a physical security issue that was related to some UFO people related things I was working, and they don't really. It was just I went out there because I had the authority to be out there, but I was given no details as to what was up on the pylon or the specifics of the test. I was just shown the airframe that was being tested.
Right. So you were shown as much as you needed to know so that you could figure out if somebody, if that leak was getting out, if it had anything to do with that, then you know. But the point that I was, that Nick was making is things are so compartmentalized,
right, exactly,
that everybody only knows a little piece of the puzzle, and maybe somebody further up the chain of command knows the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Now, I just wanted to prove to people that are listening, yes, this is how things happen.
And some of the pieces may not be accurate, because I mentioned to you before a thing called perception management, which Nick has touched on. You know, that's what all this not telling true stories, spreading to the Russians, that kind of thing, it all falls under what we call perception management.
Did you hear all that, Nick?
Yeah, I did. It was really faint, but I did pick it up okay. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we got about 7 minutes before the top of the hour where I wanted to take a break. We are talking right now actually about compartmentalization and cover stories and disinformation. Could you give us maybe a little bit of the history of the Air Force cover stories on Roswell and how your book either blows that open or kind of changes people's perception? Because at first, you know, obviously they said it was the Mogul balloons and it was the dummies.
Mm. Well, you know, I think that's one of the things that, you know, for people, perhaps some of your listeners who may not be overly familiar with Roswell, one of the curious things is the way in which even the government or the Air Force, the military, has changed its story. Initially, they stated a flying disc was recovered. Then that was this was in July 47, then that was hastily changed to a weather balloon. Then in the 1990s, that was changed to a Mogul balloon, which was designed to monitor for Soviet atomic explosions, atomic tests. But when people said, well, what about the reports of strange bodies? The response was, well, Mogul balloons didn't have passengers, so there were no alien bodies on board or alien people on board. Then in 1997, it was kind of modified, and the Air Force said, well, you know, there was some truth to the bodies story, but they weren't aliens. They were actually crash test dummies used in parachute experiments.
Right.
But then it was pointed out that the parachute test experiments didn't begin till 53. So, you know, on the one hand, you have no less than four explanations or modified explanations for what happened at Roswell. You know, people have said to me, is this indicative of a cover story? It could well be. I actually sometimes wonder, and this theory actually isn't very popular with the UFO community, but I actually sometimes wonder myself if it could be the case that today the government genuinely doesn't have a straight story of what happened at Roswell, because the secret has either been hidden or destroyed to protect, you know, whoever for whatever reasons.
Well, why are they so worried about putting out the stories?
These are the best guesstimates, if you like, of what happened.
Right. Then why are they so worried about putting out these stories?
Well, you mean worried about about the truth getting out?
Yeah, well, about if they don't know the truth, then why are these stories coming out to counteract?
Well, you know, I wonder. I mean, all the sources I interviewed for the theory that's presented in the book told me that because, obviously, if it was a crashed UFO and alien bodies, this material evidence would be stored away because it would be fantastically important material, you know, that would be analyzed for decades and decades. But as they said to me, if it was just balloons and gliders and Japanese personnel, there was nothing unique about it. So when the projects were closed down, there was no need to keep it, and also partly to, you know, to hide the paper trail, if you like, and the evidence. Again, there would be no need to store in a hangar for 50 years shredded balloon debris and a broken up glider. So they said that the material evidence was destroyed, as was the paper trail. So, you know, it may be the case that today's government or the intelligence community have fragments of the story of what happened, but they may not have a full picture. But if they know enough to know that it was pretty controversial, that may be part of the reason, at least, for introducing kind of more down-to-earth explanations, but in some ways tied in with the real story, you know, such as the balloon angle. You know, just substitute one balloon story for another balloon experiment.
So what you're saying is they may be scared of something. They don't know quite what it is, but they're making up stuff.
I actually, ironically, do wonder if that could be the case. You know, the idea that this was so well kept 60 years ago and the paper trail was destroyed to protect the people involved, and the balloons and the gliders were obviously destroyed because they weren't unique materials, but maybe something survived at a fragmentary level.
Uh-huh.
You see, what's interesting is that the people I interviewed for the book said that some of these experiments went back to 46. Now, if you look at when the General Accounting Office did its investigation into Roswell, they found that all the outgoing messages from Roswell Air Force Base, Army Air Force Base at the time, were missing from 46 to 49.
Right.
Now, if this was a UFO that quite literally crashed out of the blue in the summer of 47, there would be nothing on file about it pre-47. But if there were experiments going on prior to this in 46, that might explain why some of the files from 46 were also removed from the base.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting thing. Why remove files pre-47 if this was a crash out of the blue that nobody knew anything about?
Right.
But if it was just part of an ongoing thing that had been going on 12 months, that might explain it. But I do actually wonder, you know, if today the Air Force, you know, you have people in the Pentagon scratching their head thinking, well, we've got a few little files and fragments, but I wonder what really did happen at Roswell.
Yeah. You know what? We'll get into exactly what they were doing there and what the government might be scared of. We talked about it a little bit, but we'll get into it a little bit more after we take a little break here.
Okay.
And with Nick Redfern, we're talking about Body Snatchers in the Desert, which is Nick's new book about the Roswell incident and the amazing revelations he's uncovered. Anyway, we'll play a little music. If you want to send in an email question, why not send that to Radio Misterioso? That's RadioMisterioso, spelled in the Spanish way, at dslextreme.com, and we'll try to read them off. We've already got a couple here, and we'll get to those in a minute. So we'll be back here in a minute with Nick Redfern. Come on, play.
Greg?
Stop.